We're talking about philosophical thinking as we end this year with a healthy dose of venting on the side. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. UNESCO's director general said recently, if the health crisis calls into question several of the foundations of our societies, then philosophy helps us to move forward by stimulating critical reflection on problems that are already present, but which the pandemic is pushing to the limit. How hard was 2020 for you? Tell us what you endured and what you realized. Did you lose a loved one or maybe your livelihood? Where do you find hope? It's 800-642-1234. Kiran Setia is a philosophy professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He wrote the book Midlife, A Philosophical Guide. Kiran, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. It's great to be here again.
Well, starting out, tell us about what challenges you have faced getting through 2020 as a philosophy professor.
Well, there was the challenge of transitioning to teaching online, which happened sort of chaotically in the spring. But overall, I feel very fortunate. I mean, the main sort of sense I have of the pandemic is how lucky I am to have a job that's not threatened by the pandemic and to be sort of home with my family, and that none of us have got sick so far. I mean, my worries are mostly for my parents who are older and isolated and sort of struggling to get through this. But yeah, it's been sort of mostly for me a kind of sense of that kind of weird guilt of watching how difficult it is and feeling unable to do very much and sort of out of it, really.
Yeah, that weird guilt you mentioned there. Do you think that you took these things in your life for granted before, or were they this clear to you before the pandemic?
I do think it makes the vulnerability of health and social connection and sort of social life very much clearer to us. I mean, the inability to see people, the inability to connect with friends really makes vivid how much in-person contact matters, how much we're embodied beings, and how you know, the thing everyone complains about, that Zoom is sort of an exhausting and failed substitute for face-to-face interaction. I mean, I think that does tell us something about the kind of beings we are and the kind of life that would really be satisfying for us.
I wonder if that is a first world problem or if that has even become more of a universal problem as technology spreads around the globe.
Well, I think it's both. I mean, there's certainly a kind of, luxury. And if the main problem you have is that you're unable to work in person and that you're now doing everything online, there's a sense that, well, at least you still have your job. That's certainly how I feel. But I think that the social disconnection, that is something that is really widespread. I think at the height of the pandemic, and we're sort of returning to this right now, something like a third of the world's population were under some kind of lockdown. So it's affecting everyone in a very profound way.
At least 335,000 people have died from the pandemic. As many as 12 million are unemployed. We saw police killing several people of color this year, a brutal illustration about how our country is racked by racism, systemic racism. What do you think philosophy can offer at this moment?
Well, I think the first thing it can offer, and the thing I feel strongly about, is a kind of acknowledgement. I think there's a temptation to look to philosophy and to other things for a kind of immediate solution, some suggestion that actually it's all for the best, or it's all going to be okay, or that there's some magic formula that will enable us to get through this. And I don't think any of that is true. And I think the responsibility of philosophy and the thing that philosophy can do is sort of face up to difficult truths. So I think, first of all, a kind of acknowledgement that this is very, very difficult, that the injustice of the world is overwhelming, that the suffering and the death and the inability to mourn in the kinds of ways we would want to mourn those we've lost is really, really difficult. And trying to just think through why those things matter to us, a kind of acknowledgement of human need, is, I think, the first responsibility of philosophy. And then there's the challenge of trying to think about how to move forward, like what we can constructively do to respond to the frustration of those needs. But I think a kind of honesty and acknowledgement is part of what philosophy can offer.
Yeah, you know, philosophy can't solve it right away, but it can help us understand, maybe more get closer to the problem or what is happening, and then be able to kind of chart out where we go next.
Right, exactly. So I think there are philosophers who I've turned to who have been really helpful but also challenging. I think that the philosopher I've been reading a lot recently is Simone Weil, who was a French philosopher who lived through the First World War and into the Second World War. And, you know, she was a contemporary of Simone de Beauvoir. They were both at the École Normale Supérieure doing philosophy. And Simone Weil is a sort of amazing figure because she was both kind of spiritually alive and someone who has made a kind of practical difference. So she helped found a school for the education of railroad workers. She took part in marches and strikes. She met with Leon Trotsky and criticized him for his use of violence. She joined the Spanish Civil War. But one of the things that's sort of most iconic about her is that even since she was a child, she had a kind of sense of solidarity. So she refused to eat chocolate as a child because the soldiers on the front in the First World War were being denied their ration of sweets. And she, throughout her life, refused to heat her apartment because the unemployed could not afford to heat theirs. And she eventually died because she refused to eat more than the minimum ration, even as she was suffering from tuberculosis. And I think that she's a kind of model not exactly to emulate, because I think it's impossible and perhaps misguided to try to emulate that. But her life sort of is an icon for sort of thinking through what it would mean to try to take the injustice of the world and the suffering of others seriously, even from a position where one is not oneself, as I'm not a sort of primary victim of that suffering or injustice. And so I think her work and her model is something that I found very captivating as I've been sort of turning to philosophy during the pandemic.
We're talking with Kiran Setia, professor at MIT, as we look at this year, 2020. Kiran, one philosophy that there's been such a resurgence during the pandemic is Stoicism. And a little bird told me that you're not a fan of Stoicism. No rational thought for you, distinguishing between things that you're in control of, things you're not in control of. What's your beef there with Stoicism?
Well, the sort of the key Stoic idea is that you should distinguish. I mean, some of this sort of seems exactly right. You should distinguish between the things that you have control over and the things you don't have control over, and focus on what you have control over. But there's a sort of radical idea in Stoicism that you should sort of become indifferent to the things you don't have control over. And if you look back to the origins of this, Epictetus, who was a Roman slave, who was one of the great Stoic philosophers, was a slave. I mean, and part of what he was arguing was that once he recognized that he had no control over that, he should be okay with it. He should sort of disengage from that. And I think that's sort of a disturbing idea. I think the idea that it's a mistake not to recognize that even the things you don't have control over matter. It takes a certain kind of courage to face up to the fact that you don't have control over them. But I think it's the wrong response to sort of set that aside. There's actually a review. The novelist Henry James reviewed a new edition of Epictetus. I think this was in 1866. And sort of imagined what it would be like if an African slave echoed Epictetus and said, well, you know, I'm okay with this because I have no control over it. And I think that's a kind of, it's a way of closing your eyes to something that really matters.
MIT philosopher Kiran Setia. We'll be back in a moment with him here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at 2020 through a philosopher's lens, helping us cope with what came up this year. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche was dedicated to finding the meaning in life, and he said to live is to suffer, and he doubled that. He doubted that pain makes us better, but he knew it makes us deeper. What philosopher's words speak to you now? Have you discovered new truths this year? Share your reflections on the year 800-642-1234. And what a pleasure to have MIT philosophy professor Kiran Setia here for the hour. Let's take a call now. Mark is joining us from Madison. Hi, Mark. What would you like to add?
Well, hi. I have a conjecture for the philosopher, and that is, I wonder if the virus has presented the world and all the nations of the world with a test of individuality versus community values. We see many nations, for instance, Taiwan has 22 million people. They've had about 900 cases, 10 deaths, and they dealt with this very early on. And life there has been essentially normal. So that is such a striking difference in comparison to the U.S., which we would think is perhaps the most individualistic country in the world.
Kiran, where do you see individualism?
Well, I think there's definitely something to that. And I think we're going to be tested again, because I think one of the sort of core ideas of vaccination is that it's a social phenomenon. Like, but being vaccinated is as much about the fact that in being vaccinated, one protects other people and reduces the spread of the virus as it is about protecting oneself. And so the question of how people are going to buy into that and how much resistance there will be will again put pressure on this sort of ideology of individualism. So I do think there's something to that. And I think, that's a challenge that the U.S. is going to face in a particular way. On the other hand, I think there's also a kind of failure of government. I mean, that even the ideology of individualism would not have prevented a much more vigorous and effective response to the crisis. And even now, you know, the Defense Production Act could be invoked. We could be producing vaccines at a larger scale and distributing them in a more effective way. So I think it's not just sort of ideology or people's individualism. I think that there are a kind of government failures that people are rightly angry about.
Well, Mark brings up community, and it's less obvious how we can confront a pandemic through our actions. How can we approach the pandemic with an eye on making a difference or being a helper?
I think that's one of the ways in which it's very hard. I mean, I think this is a more general problem that is brought to light by the kind of the case of Simone Weil that I mentioned before, that there's a sense in which her attempt at solidarity by refusing to eat when others starve was kind of pointless. I mean, it's not helping anyone, but it's an expression of a kind of desire to do something in conditions where we can't do very much. And I think that impulse is real. And my sense is that the way to think about it is to not be overwhelmed. It can easily be paralyzing. It can lead to just sort of the kind of superficial doom scrolling where you are constantly inundated with terrible things, but feel unable to do anything about them. And really the advice I have, or the kind of picture I have of how to approach this, is to not give in to that kind of paralysis, just to find one thing, find one kind of group you can connect with that's doing something that seems helpful, like the mutual aid organizations that have sprung up in the pandemic. Or a kind of local organization associated with Black Lives Matter. Like, find an existing organization that you can plug into so you don't have to become a kind of leader on your own, and you can become part of something that's already happening. And that's a way, I think, to feel like you have some agency in a time that otherwise feels very disempowering.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Kiran Setia, who's a professor of philosophy at MIT, author of the book Midlife. We're looking at the year that was through a more of a philosophical bent. What did you turn to for solace or understanding during this difficult year? Did you find hope from literature or art or religion, philosophy? Tell us what you kept going through in 2020 and how you confronted it. 800-642-1234. Kiran, you talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and the renewed attention to our country's history of white supremacy. What obligations do we have to address our country's racism and to act on it as individuals?
Here, I think there's another philosopher who I've been reading who I'm finding very helpful on this, which is Iris Marion Young, who is a political philosopher who died just in 2006. She was one of the philosophers who sort of developed the idea of structural injustice, the idea that even when individuals are not acting unjustly and there's no specific unjust policy, injustice can sort of emerge structurally in the way it does in, for instance, education in the U.S. And I think one of the distinctions she made that's really important is to distinguish responsibility in the sense of blame from a kind of forward-looking responsibility to make a difference. And I think, so the first thing to say is that responsibility for making a difference to racism in the U.S. and the kind of racist structural racism in the U.S. is not about blame. It's not about white people now being especially at fault. Some are, some aren't. It's about the ways in which we sort of participate in and benefit from that kind of the history of racism. And so I think the responsibility there is a responsibility to do something. And the challenge, again, is to find what philosophers call the agent of change, like to find not just to wish for change, but to find some possible group that could make a difference. So I think that partly is a matter of electoral politics and voting, but it's also a matter of organizations like Black Lives Matter, participating in them, and also a matter of putting pressure on politicians who won't actually do what we want them to do unless we continue to sort of exert that pressure on them.
But the morality of it, how do I know if I am doing enough or if I'm doing the right thing? What about the morals here?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is that it's always going to be painful. I think even if you think, well, I can't be expected to be like Simone Weil and sacrifice everything, that's unrealistic. I have to proportion my expectations of myself to my own temperament, my own character, my own abilities. We never really know where those limits are. And so I think whatever we're doing, we're always going to be faced with uncertainty about whether we're doing enough, whether we should be doing more. And that's just, again, I think philosophy is not going to take that away. I think what it can do is explain why we are bound to feel that way. Even people who are devoting their lives to fighting injustice probably think to themselves, I could be doing even more. And so I'm not sure there is a solution to that, except to say that's what it means to live under conditions of responsibility for justice when they can't really be met and where we don't really know and can never really know if we ourselves have done enough.
Let's bring in Laura now, joining us from Madison with thoughts. Hi, Laura.
Hi, good morning. Happy, I hope, New Year to everyone.
Thanks.
I struggle, and I wonder if your philosophy professor would be the right person to answer this. If our understanding of compassion and caring for other people is translated into this push to save more lives in the pandemic and not let anyone die, how do we balance that against our knowledge that our entire planet is dying because there are essentially too many people on it? Isn't it more compassionate and saving of more people in the long run if we stop trying to, I don't mean to sound harsh, but save every 90-year-old who gets the COVID-19?
Okay, Laura, thank you for that. Kieran, what do you hear there in terms of our population on our planet versus trying to solve COVID and to save people?
I think it would be a kind of extreme reaction, a kind of problematic reaction, if our sense of overpopulation led us to lose our appreciation for the dignity of life and the sense that we should preserve and protect the lives of those who already exist. I think it does make sense to think in terms of sort of education for reproductive education and the ways in which we might be able to prevent future overpopulation. But I think it's sort of a bleak, I think the outcome in which we decide to that human life doesn't have or can't be understood to have the kind of dignity we believed it had and that people are sort of dispensable, that would be a kind of dystopian outcome of this.
Yeah.
I think we're not at the point where we have to give up on that yet, even though we are at a point where the kind of climate crisis is intense and urgent.
We're talking with philosopher Kiran Setia, who's helping us make sense of this difficult year, giving us some clarity as 2020 comes to a close. What are you thinking about on this day? Have you gone on walks alone or sat with your thoughts? What did you discover about yourself or the world? How have you bore your losses this year, and where do you find the will to move on? There's room for you in the discussion, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick this up with Kiran Setia after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. On this final day of 2020, we're leaning into philosophical thinking to help sort through what has transpired. Thanks for being with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Can the love for wisdom, as it's classically defined, give us more clarity in a time of loss and economic and political distress? What did you turn to for understanding during this difficult year? Do you find hope in reading or in literature, in art, religion? Is there a dead poet or a philosopher you are quoting? Share with us, 800-642-1234. What a pleasure to spend the hour with MIT philosophy professor Kiran Setia. Let's take another call now. Dave is with us from Middleton. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I'm going to start. I'm an interstate truck driver. I've been an interstate truck driver for 40 years and dealt with accidents and police. And I used to be a trainer where I was in a cab for 3 weeks with never knew who I was going to get. Most of them are young black men. And it's really striking to me because of what they hear on radio, television, how different their mindset is about this country and life in general. But after spending time like in a space capsule with these people, you know, you got to get along. I mean, we're now no more than a foot away from each other. I think the news media would do a great service to this country if they would stop inciting and not exactly telling the truth, more inciting the news than actually telling the truth. Because after I spent time with some of these people, some of these young men, They get the feeling like there's not that much that separates us as human beings. We all have a mother, a father. We all have kids. But systemic racism and inequities in this country, life's not fair. This country's never been fair. It all comes down to the individual to take charge of their own life. And yeah, life's not fair. It hasn't been fair to me. I've had my lumps, but I think systemic shooting of black men. I had an uncle that was a Michigan State Trooper, retired. Look, there's more to this story. And when you go and throw things out like that, you know, just like the cops are walking up and shooting somebody.
Dave, I want to get Kiran to be able to jump in here on this idea that there isn't that much that separates us. Kiran? Oh, Kiran, are you there? I think we're having some trouble hearing.
No, I'm here.
No, you're here. Yeah.
I was briefly muted. Okay. It's not Zoom, but you know, we're all used to the accidental mute right now. I think part of that story that's heartening is just the overcoming of segregation. I think one of the problems of the sort of de facto segregation of the U.S. is how little interaction there is, relatively speaking, between white people and black people, and how, as philosophers put it, epistemically, in terms of knowledge and understanding, that really limits us. I mean, I don't think the right response to the sort of persistent unfairness and injustice of the world, which I agree is pervasive, that I don't think the right response is resignation. I think we should focus on it and try to change it. But I do think there's something to the idea that it will be bad if, by focusing on certain kinds of injustice, we generate division. I mean, one thing that I think is under discussed and is class as a form both of as a kind of axis both of oppression and exclusion, and as a form and basis of solidarity. So I think the idea of sort of building bridges that can connect people and help them see how they might be joined by injustice and the fight against it is a hopeful thought.
When you say class, do you mean like class systems? And share a little more there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think so. You know, there's, I mean, yeah, class in terms of wealth and uh-huh. income. So, you know, one thing to say about police violence against young black men is that there's also a disproportionate rate of homicide of the police against poor white men. So I don't know exactly how the figures compare, but I think both of those seem like forms of injustice we should care about, and it would be bad to neglect one in favor of the other. I don't think that means we shouldn't support Black Lives Matter or that the prominence given to that has been some kind of mistake, but I do think that there are kind of potential for solidarity there that is untapped.
Your students come from all backgrounds, all walks of life, from all experiences. Do you find that when you're able to put them together and to be able to talk, do they learn things that they haven't really felt or discovered before?
Definitely, yes. I mean, one thing that is heartening to me is seeing how students have come together and under very, very difficult conditions. I think it's an extraordinarily hard time to be a young person. It was already an extraordinarily hard time to be a young person before the pandemic in terms of the sort of prospects for wealth and security and healthcare and so on. But I think watching students talk to each other and interact with each other is inspiring. And I think the kind of context that college classrooms can provide are great for that. I think it would be also great if there were more avenues outside of college classrooms for people of different backgrounds and different kinds of life experiences to come together and interact. I think it would be a shame if it was the only real venue for that was the college classroom.
Yeah. Let me reintroduce you. We're talking with Kiran Setia, who's a professor of philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's currently working on a book about how philosophy can help people deal with life's adversities. You can join in on what this year has meant to you. Where do you look for clarity, inspiration? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Lily now, joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Lily. What is on your mind?
Good morning. So over COVID, actually quite early on, I started researching for books that I wanted to collect, and David White's Consolations, I ended up with this book, and it's so beautiful. He goes over everyday words and has a meditative writing on it. Some of these words, such as alone, courage, forgiveness, heartbreak, loneliness, vulnerability, and withdrawal, those are just a few. But it's 245 pages of writing that I think a lot of people could find.
Is there a particular passage or word that you could share with us?
They're quite long, maybe... how about this one? Despair. Despair takes us in when we have nowhere else to go. When we feel the heart cannot break anymore. When our world or our loved ones disappear. When we feel we cannot be loved or do not deserve to be loved. When our God disappoints us or when our body is carrying profound pain in a way that does not seem to go away. But he always goes on and the story goes through a life cycle, each one.
Lily, thank you for bringing that. The book Consolations, the Solace, Nourishment, and Underlying Meaning of Everyday Words. Kiran?
That was wonderful. I will look the book up. I didn't know it before, and it sounds amazing. Yeah, I've certainly turned to art and literature as sources of consolation. There's a wonderful book called The Triggering Town by the poet Richard Hugo that has a line that I think is it's been very meaningful to me. He says, it may be the most important lesson I ever learned, maybe the most important lesson one can teach. You are someone and you have a right to your life. And I think that I think dealing with that fact is sort of part of the challenge, the sense that of balancing the sense of responsibility for other people and for the injustice of the world and the suffering of others with the fact that you have a right to your life, you have a right to your own suffering and a right to your own consolation. And again, I don't think there's a simple solution to that dilemma, but I find art and literature as well as philosophy very helpful in trying to live through it.
As you work on your book about how to help people cope with adversity, have your thoughts on that changed during this year?
Well, they've definitely changed. I mean, I began the book, I was working on the book before the pandemic, and so it became sort of weirdly and unhappily timely in that I had been thinking about loneliness sort of researching, for instance, people have been talking about a kind of crisis of loneliness. But actually the social science suggested that the more I read about it, the more it seemed like, well, actually, it wasn't really clear that loneliness was more epidemic now than it was in 1970. And then the pandemic hit, and now it's just absolutely, you know, no one could deny that there's a kind of epidemic crisis of loneliness. So I think that the sheer, the way in which illness and loneliness have been made pervasive and sort of present to everyone's lives has changed my sense of the priority and the urgency of those kinds of challenges. I mean, I think there's something that came out in that passage about despair that I struggle with and haven't really resolved, which is this sort of ongoing question of how to think about hope and whether hope, putting it crudely, is a good thing or a bad thing. And this sort of ambivalence about hope goes all the way back to the story of Pandora's box, where all the evils escape and hope is left behind. And then the question is, well, hold on, if it was a box of evils, is the implication there that hope is actually an evil thing because it makes us passive in the face of injustice? We just hope it will all work out. Or can we find a way to think about hope as a positive thing? And that's something that I feel like my thinking on that, I don't know if I've reached a resolution, but through the course of this year, I've been asking myself the question sort of what to hope for and how to hope.
Yeah, because hope sometimes now gets kind of an eye roll. When you say hope.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. And it can sound like a kind of resignation or passivity. And so if there's to be a form of hope that really we should embrace, it would have to be a kind of active hope that is kind of consistent with and supports our agency to actually make a difference.
Philosopher Kiran Satya helping us interpret the world as we close the books on 2020. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Philosophers around the world have been writing about the pandemic and the lessons everyone can learn, can take away. In all the darkness of this year, we're leaning into philosophy to find meaning, to talk it through. We have MIT philosopher Kiran Satya, the author of Midlife, a Philosophical Guide, and he's with us for 10 more minutes. We had a call here who couldn't stay with us but wanted to mention that Marcus Aurelius' Meditations, the Roman emperor, the Stoic philosopher, that they have been reading those. What do you think about Aurelius?
Well, we already talked a little bit about
my
attitude to Stoicism. I mean, it's complicated because my general reaction is anything that anyone finds helpful is good, and I would not begrudge anyone consolation they can find in the course of the pandemic. I mean, I guess part of what I think is sort of problematic about Stoicism is that sort of contemporary Stoicism severs the idea of giving up on what you don't have control over from the sort of the theism of Stoicism. So the Stoics themselves believed that the universe was sort of divine, and that meant that there was a guarantee that even if things seemed bad, Zeus would sort of stealthily make sure that everything worked out for the best.
To save the day.
Yeah. And if you have that kind of view, it sort of makes sense to say, don't worry about what's not under your control. You know, God is going to take care of it. And I think once you sever Stoicism from that idea, because I think most contemporary Stoics are not, don't believe in that part of it. That's what I think makes it doesn't really stand up on its own in the same way. So that's part of what I think is problematic about the sort of anachronistic appeal to Stoicism that's become popular now. But no, I think there's still plenty of wisdom in Stoicism. And if people find reading Aurelius helpful, then read Aurelius. I mean, I think philosophy is something that people sort of relate to in a very personal way. And, you know, I have my views. Not everyone has to agree with them. And so maybe I'm wrong.
Let's bring in Marcus now in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. So I wrote something during the COVID break called Embrace Hope. It goes like this. I believe that hope is like happiness. It's something that you absolutely have to have inside of yourself. Because if you expect someone else to make you happy or hopeful, you're simultaneously giving them the power to make you unhappy. Because my grandfather used to tell me, if you're alive today and have breath in your lungs, then we have the power to make today better than yesterday. Remember that hope is the one thing that can't be taken from you. It is something only you can give up. So please don't do that. Never give up hope.
Marcus, thank you for that. Kieran, you know, Marcus really saying hope comes from within.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that in part because it was about the way in which hope is directed towards agency. It's not hoping for some miracle that someone else will provide. Hope is understood there to be something that one is oneself responsible for. And that does sound to me like the kind of way of hoping that we should embrace, that seems like the right way to hope. I think hope is not by itself simply a good thing. You can hope well, you can hope badly. And that seems like a kind of part of a model of hoping well.
You know, reading philosophy can sometimes be, philosophers can be really hard to read. Are there writers you recommend for, you know, armchair philosophers, lay people?
That's a good question. I should have a better answer to that because I do think that there are philosophers who are accessible. And that I kind of, one of my goals in life is to make philosophy more accessible and to have people read philosophy. I think Simone Weil, who I've been reading, is not difficult the way contemporary philosophers are difficult. I think her stuff is inspiring and moving, and it's difficult because it's often obscure and sort of elliptical. It's not technical in any way. And so she's a philosopher who I think people could read. I think Gravity and Grace is one of her most accessible books, but also she has collections of essays that are easy to find, and they're very beautiful in the fact that they do manage to combine a kind of spiritual inner sense of the demands of happiness and justice with a kind of applied political realism, an honesty and practicality about the injustice of the world and what actually has to be done about it. So she's someone who I've definitely turned to and found consoling.
We're talking with Kieran Setia, who's a professor of philosophy at MIT, author of the book Midlife. We're looking at the year through a philosophical lens and taking your insights as well, 800-642-1234. Kieran, hopefully every year won't be a 2020. What can philosophy, though, teach us about good times, about when things seem to be just kind of humming right along?
Well, I think one thing that we learn about good times and that's connected with the experience we're going through now is the possibility of finding pockets of happiness and joy, even in very difficult and dark times. So sometimes that's about consolation. Other times it's just about enjoying music or art or stand-up comedy is one of my favorite sort of distractions during the pandemic. And I do think there's a kind of tyranny of the ameliorative that we have to resist, which is the sense that because the most urgent thing is to deal with the problems of the world, there's no space for anything else. And I think that can't be the right approach. It would be sort of ultimately a kind of life-negating approach not to embrace, even in dark times, art and its sort of power to inspire us. I was reading recently, there's an amazing book called Landscapes of the Metropolis of Death, by a guy called Otto Dovkulka, who was a child in Auschwitz.
Mm.
And a big part of the book is about singing in a choir and telling jokes. And amidst incredible horror, he manages to kind of learn about history and the classics and music. And, you know, we're not going through Auschwitz right now, but I think one thing philosophy can do is help us see that it's not self-indulgent to cling to the beauty and the meaning of art and friendship and family and personal connections in times like this, that those are what hold out the promise for a kind of future happiness.
Yeah, and when the pandemic takes up so much oxygen, like all the oxygen, all of the being in the air, what happens when that oxygen is replaced, when that space is back? That I'm really curious about what will happen.
It will be kind of, I find it utterly unpredictable and baffling. And I like you, I'm waiting to see what will happen. I mean, people say that, you know, after the First World War and the 1918 flu was the Roaring Twenties.
Mm-hmm.
And, post hoc ergo propter hoc or whatever. We don't know cause and effect there, but there was a sort of decade of wild partying. So who knows what the next decade will bring. Maybe we've earned it. But I hope it will also bring a kind of, I hope we don't forget. I hope we take into the next decade a memory of and a sense of the dangers of the world and the injustice that's been exposed in the last year and the will to keep fighting for it.
Yeah, and wondering how will we explain this time to a generation that didn't experience it? Or, you know, do you keep a journal? You know, should you be writing this down?
That's a great question. It's funny, I have not been keeping a journal, but we, just to give our son, who's 14, something to do, we told him, you know, why don't you keep a journal? So he has been writing a page a day through the whole pandemic, mm-hmm. and we haven't read any of it. And so it's his private journal. But part of the idea there was that he will have a record. You know, he's someone who at 14, the unprecedentedness of this is a little, he doesn't have as much context for that as we do. We can keep telling him, oh my, nothing like this has ever happened to us. But he will, I hope, later in life, be able to look back and have a kind of record of a time that will help him to remember something that will, I hope, not be part of his future. So I think there is a real value in that. Yeah.
Oh, I really like that idea, and being able to just have that to hold on to and perhaps look back at maybe decades later, late in life.
Right, exactly. And it will, I think it's part of what's, I hope, will be meaningful about it is that it's not just a window into the pandemic, but also a window into his life at 14. Like, I think any 14-year-old at any point, if you wrote a page a day and then read it 30 years later, that would be interesting. But under these circumstances, especially so.
Oh, Kieran, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
Kieran Setia, professor of philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, author of the book Midlife, A Philosophical Guide. He's currently working on a book about how philosophy can help people with life's adversities. Just ahead, it is 1 a.m. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.